You're listening to the highlights from the Creative Process Podcast's interview with Jaron Lanier, computer scientist, musician, writer, and pioneer of virtual reality. The Creative Process Podcast is supported by the Jan Michalski Foundation.
AI is obviously the dominant topic in tech lately. And I think occasionally there's AI that's nonsense and occasionally there's AI that's great. You know, I love finding new proteins for medicine and so on. It's great. There's a lot of really wonderful stuff in AI. What I meant when I said there is no AI is that I don't think we serve ourselves well when we put our own technology up on a pedestal as if it were a new god that we created. I think we're really getting a little too full of ourselves to think well when we do that. I think we confuse ourselves too easily. This goes back to Alan Turing, the main founder of computer science, who had this idea of the Turing test, which is it's really hard to make some kind of a meter for what a human is. You don't have like a consciousness meter or something. And so if an AI can fool a person, we should treat that as being as good a confirmation as we'll get. We should treat it as real. So he imagined this test where there'd be a person and an AI computer to be treated as real and then a judge. And what I would say is in the test, you can't tell whether the computer has gotten more human-like or the human has gotten more computer-like because people are very prone to becoming more computer-like. Like when we're on social media, we let ourselves be guided by the algorithms so that we start to become dumb like the algorithms want us to. And you see that all the time. It's really degraded our psychologies and our society. I'm really surprised at how poor social VR is. I mean, the term virtual reality, the reality in there was supposed to mean social. That was the original intent of the term. I still like the stuff. I still enjoy putting on a headset. You know, and I think some of them have gotten good in some ways. The styles of interaction that are available are kind of inferior to what we could do in the 80s, because in the 80s, the graphics were so bad that we had to really focus on haptics and on sound. And so those were done pretty well. And now the graphics are both cheap and higher quality. And in a way, people have gotten lazy, I think, about interaction. And a lot of the interactions are, I think, really uninteresting. I mean, I think the most interesting thing about virtual reality is being in there with your body and really moving. And we used to do it with clothing, with instrumented gloves and things like that. And now, of course, it's done with cameras and other kinds of sensors. I'm a little suspicious of the doctrine of the special person, where like this one is really creative compared to that one. That I'm unusual, I think, is probably true. I'm a little hesitant to buy into a claim that I'm more whatever than somebody else. This is a thing that we tend to do. We tend to say, oh, this person's exceptionally brilliant and this one's exceptionally creative. And I mean, maybe, but on the other hand, I think we sometimes miss those things in people that we treat as being more ordinary. So I'm just a little suspicious of it. I want to hem and haw a bit on that level. And then the other thing is like, I don't know how much insight we really have into ourselves. I think in my case, I had parents who were somewhat similar, but then I lost my mom very early on in a way that was the trauma of my life and continues to be in a way. And it does come out of trauma. I think what knocks us off course is often not some really positive and pleasant thing. So it's possible that there's this sort of spirit in which a question like that can be asked, which is like, well, why can't you give us insight that will help everybody to be like you? And my initial thought is, God, I wouldn't wish that on people. A lot of eccentricity is probably a response to trauma in many cases. So we have enough trauma in the world as it is. I do have this kind of obsessive thing about finding and learning new obscure musical instruments. And in fact, one of my problems in life is I've kind of run out. I have at this point possibly a comprehensive tour of the instruments, you know, or close to it. So it's getting harder and harder to find new adventures. But at any rate, it started, my mom had taught me music. And when she died, somehow I just became obsessed with learning new instruments. Because I remember that experience of her teaching me piano. And of course, I still play the piano, but I also just crave that experience of learning new instruments, which is sort of a connection to her, I suppose. So that's probably the best explanation. But then there's a lot more. I mean, I always think of instruments as some of the most optimistic signals for human nature that we find in history, because there's a cliche that it's the weapons of war that drive technology. And of course, that's true in many cases, but it's also true in many cases that it's musical instruments instruments that drive technology. The musical bow logically had to precede the bow and arrow, and casting bells preceded casting cannons and guns. And the first product sold by Silicon Valley Company was Hewlett-Packard's music synthesizer for Walt Disney for the movie Fantasia. Those are some of the examples I like. But at any rate, the point is that we find in musical instruments this incredible drive for technological innovation. The plagiarism is not part of the AI algorithm. It's part of the societal framing of the AI algorithm. And it's very important to understand that and to understand how that could change without reducing any benefits that there might be. I think the Wikipedia set us on a bad path because the Wikipedia, in a way, and it even goes further back, even Search was trying to simulate an AI, like Yahoo was like yet another hallowed oracle. The idea was that there'd be this oracle. And so by erasing the people, you'd create this illusion of this new entity. And then the Wikipedia continued that illusion with the emphasis on pseudonyms. And at least pseudonyms are something. So there's a bit of continuity, but I would have preferred to see a tendency towards true names in the Wikipedia, not a requirement. There are reasons for some people not to do it, but I think this default to pseudonyms did tend to create this illusion of the one true rendering of truth, which is not necessarily great. And then with AI, we've pushed that even further of just erasing people. But we don't have to erase people to get whatever benefits you might seek from the types of large models that we're building now. And I should point out, for those who are wondering, well, what's he doing at Microsoft? I think this is a win-win idea. I think that when we elevate society, we elevate all the parts of society, including even the tech companies. So I think those who think that there's this inherent opposition between tech companies and people who provide data out there, I think they're just wrong. I think that's just a logical error and they're making a mistake. The terminology gets a bit confusing. Back in the old days, meaning going to the late 70s, I guess, virtual reality was a social version of a virtual world. The virtual world was coined by an art theorist named Suzanne Langer in the 50s as an idea. And then Ivan Sutherland, the father of computer graphics, adopted it. And virtual reality was supposed to be the social version of that. And mixed reality was the thing that we kind of call augmented these days. I don't know, but the terms are all over the place and everybody wants to be able to get to coin the new term, I've noticed. So as far as like wearing goggles all the time, I don't know. I've always thought it was dumb. Like from when I was young, I always thought that the most special moment with virtual reality or anything similar was when you take them off, because then you see the world with fresh eyes. That moment of coming out is what's so magical. It's like sometimes if you see a really good movie and there's that moment when you leave the theater and you have altered perception for a moment, like that actually is the best part of the movie, isn't it? And I've always thought that this notion of just being in VR all the time would just make it boring and ordinary and miss the point and ruin it. You know, I think it's just a poorly informed idea. It's not based on a lot of experience with it, perhaps. I don't know. Obviously, if you have a company that's selling headsets, you'd want to promote that idea because then you sell more headsets. I mean, sure. And everybody wants the next iPhone. Everybody would like to be able to sell the ubiquitous device. Of course, of course, of course, of course. Look what that did for Apple, right? It's huge. So my own sense is, like, the usual reason people give for why it might not work is that people don't like how they look with glasses on. I don't think that's it exactly, because that's very subjective and people's subjective sense of what's attractive can shift from generation to generation and who knows. But I just think this idea of making something special into something ordinary is what'll turn people off. I don't know, like there's the occasional chocoholic that's just nibbling on chocolate all day long, but it's much more common for them to have punctuated equilibrium in their chocolate so they enjoy it when it comes up or something. I don't know. I just think people naturally gravitate to want virtual reality to be special instead of ordinary. Right now, most AI services by far do not trace the human origins of the data that they're relying on the most to generate what you see or what you read from moment to moment. Could it be done technically? I think so. I'm certainly working on that. There is a small world of researchers who study that question and trying to figure it out. And we know a fair amount about it. I don't want to pretend that all the problems are solved and we know everything about how to do it, but certainly working on it, and I believe it can be done. The one thing I think I should say at this juncture is that their motivations to do it, aside from a sense of societal quality and promoting human values and fairness and such things, there's also a sort of a short-term or sort of more immediate motivation, which has to do with safety and quality. So I want to explain that because I think it's often underemphasized. Right now, there are techniques like indirect prompt injection is a famous one, where you can trick an AI system system into giving you content that we prefer you not get. For instance, can you take a picture of a kitchen and say, tell me how I can make a bomb from the available things you see in this? All right. So that's like a big no-no. And that's the kind of thing that responsible AI systems flag. I don't know how many of them are responsible in that way. I think there are more and more of them that maybe are not. But at any rate, if somebody's very clever about how they ask for that, it might not be apparent in the prompt or in the output that that's what's going on. For instance, they might ask for a cake recipe from available things, but as it would be done by some character who's a bomb maker in a movie, for instance, or something like that. They might find some Weasley way to get there, and then the output might come out not making it obvious that it's a bomb. So how do you fix that? So in security, we have this idea called multi-factor authentication. So like when you try to log on to some site that has financial information, they'll also send a code to your phone, for instance. And the reason for that is that any kind of thing you can do directly on that one site, like a capture or something, a bad actor might be able to intercept. But as soon as there's multiple channels, it becomes that much harder for them. Not impossible, but you make life harder for them. So in the same way with AI, a lot of the ways that we try to make AI safer are by adding some twist to the AI itself, where there's some kind of guardrail. But if you have a whole other factor, then it makes it that much harder for weird, malicious, or accidental horrible things to happen. And going back to the human sources is a separate factor. If you say, well, what were the original sources relied upon to generate this output? If there's a bomb document in there, you got them, right? And indirect prompt injection is not going to hide that bomb document. And so I think it's important for us to understand that this idea of being human-centered makes the whole thing more reality-centered. It makes it all safer and better. It's a way of improving quality, and it's not just lofty utopian societal goals. And so I've been trying to emphasize that side of things more and more, because I think it's easier to make progress on that basis for now before we try to reinvent all of digital society. I think young people are overwhelmed by the attention battles of unimportant and very transient things on social media now. So young people are, and this wasn't entirely untrue for other recent generations, but it's just true beyond some sort of threshold now that seems important to me. So they'll tend to know about two pretty unimportant, uninteresting social media personalities who don't really matter, but they'll get into a conflict that generates a lot of attention, and that sort of thing will dominate them to the degree that they tend to be politically engaged in a package deal totality kind of a way. Like if you're left, you buy every left idea at once. And if you're right, you buy every right idea at once. And I so very much wish I could snap them out of that and get them to be a little more nuanced and say, well, maybe I agree with 2/3 of the left ideas, but then there's 1/3 I don't, or of right ideas. And then also in terms of knowledge of history, I'm a little concerned that the traditional teaching of history might have become a little too sclerotic or static or something. But on the other hand, what a lot of kids know is just so based on whatever somebody was saying at the time. Both the left and the right in the United States have emphases in their own tellings of history that are kind of weirdly askew and extreme and unfortunate. And it's very hard for a young person to get any kind of a balanced sense of thinking about how we got here, you know? And we have a lot of work to do. That's all I can say. My generation dove in and did the internet with this sense of urgency and self-certainty, and it'll take generations to fix now. So that's what happened.
The music on this episode is by Jaron Lanier from his piano improv performance at Pioneer Works in Brooklyn in 2024.
We hope you enjoyed this highlights reel brought to you by The Creative Process. If you'd like to get involved with our creative community, exhibitions, or podcasts, or submit your creative works for review, just follow us on Instagram @creativeprocesspodcast and send us a message. Thank you for listening.